Are we live? Great, okay, here we go. You're ready. So, I'm Matt Brandt, one of the web QAs with Mozilla, and I'm very pleased to present to you Shmuel Gershon from Intel's Jerusalem campus. He's going to speak today a bit about exploratory testing and session-based testing, and then a bit about a tool that he offered. No, it's actually open source. We'll have links posted. But to help himself and his team in their testing endeavors. I'm very pleased to give you over to Shmuel now.
Hi. The first applause. Thank you. Let's see if we'll have applause at the end too. And okay, so I'm very happy to be here. I think I'm proud to be here, which is selfish, but I think it's also nice to hear. Thanks to Matt for inviting me. I just met him face to face very recently. We knew each other on it in the web. He's a great guy, very creative into coming with subjects for talking. And thanks Mozilla for hosting me. This is a very unusual opportunity, like being invited to talk. Usually I ask to talk and people just ignore me. So this is really a different experience for me. Matt promised me that this can be a conversation. So as you'll see, I don't have more than a rough outline of what I want to cover here. So you are welcome to ask questions and direct the talk to any different place. I can adapt. And I will not have answers for everything, but I'll have more questions for any question that you'll be able to come up. So we should be good at that. This is more or less what we'll cover, a little bit of view on exploration and on session-based. I'll tell short stories of how we do that at Intel there, and I'll present this tool for you too. So, let's see. This is me. I don't have content, so you have a title and I'll speak the content out. I believe Matt invited me because I have a particular view on software testing. But by particular, I don't mean that it's special or it's different. Actually, my views are shared by many of the members of the community. I refer to it as particular because it's a personal view that fits my personal philosophy, borrowed from different sources and different books and many people that I've met. I've been working as a tester, receiving money for tests for the last 6 years, all of them at Intel Corporation. I did tests before that, but I was a programmer. I didn't notice that I liked more to test the things that I wrote than to write them. But I did a very poor job because I was very biased by my own programming. But for 5 years before starting to test, I worked as a programmer for many different types of software, writing software in different types of languages, uncomfortable languages like C and uncomfortable ones like Delphi. I think this is an interesting distinction for languages. I don't really much care about the technical aspects of the language, but I think there are languages that are uncomfortable, like assembly, uncomfortable, like HP. Even if you don't like HP, they're comfortable because you can just have things written very big. I am focusing on these aspects of programming because I come to Mozilla with a big prejudice about how Mozilla works. And I want to have an answer here to one question. I view many companies they come with an objective of providing a product or a service. So, and I see Mozilla as having the objective of producing code. That's the essence of it. It's a big open source company. So I have a prejudice of, and I want to know how focused or biased towards code and automation is Mozilla, in your view, compared to other places. And you can answer it, no one else. You have to answer more questions.
Very, very well.
So,
Let's say we have a very thick automation strategy, although QA is in the process of catching up with it to some degree. The unit testing strategy at Mozilla is excellent. I think it probably has done a huge amount for our code stability over the last couple of years since it's been adopted. As far as product automation goes, that's still underway. I mean, we're building, I think web is a little bit ahead of product in that regard. But there's definitely a focus on it in our team and other ones.
Okay, so for the answer that I'll summarize the parts that are important for me, I see that there is a big automation going on outside the real product. So a lot of parallel coding things going on, and you say that the testing is still trying to catch up with that. That's more or less what you said. And I don't see anyone disagreeing. So that is what I believe. So I was guessing that there is like this feeling that the testing here had to catch up with automation because that's what all the rest of the company is doing. It's a company of coders and source code. They take a lot of value here. That's what Mozilla came up. So I'll take this point of automation to start to explain how I do testing, and I would like to have discussion with anything you don't agree. So I'll tell one story, a short story of something that happened with us at Intel. And I hope I don't disclose secrets, otherwise I'll be killed as soon as I leave the building. And we had one pilot, one project where we did all the tests based on exploration, all manual, no test runs before that, and using sessions that we will cover in a while. And one part of this product had interface with many, many different components and platforms. We worked a lot related to the hardware that we were working. And to the extent that the testers felt we would not be able to cover all of them if they tried manually. As much as I come from a programming background, I did not encourage them to do this automated. And the tester requested, as I said, let's build something to simulate the different interfaces that we have here and just have this automated in at least one after the other. And I didn't believe in that very much, and I asked him not to do that. I preferred to have the feeling of the real product instead of building stubs and mocks in the process. And I'm very happy that he proved me wrong. He insisted, he said, after he started manually, he said, there's much more here than we can cover. I will do an automation, and he spent a few days writing it. And he really proved me wrong. We found many bugs and many problems. The other parts of the product, programmers and managers are happy with finding bugs with automation. So I was wrong in that part, but I was happy that we let our first exploration and our first feeling determine that we wanted to automate that thing, instead of just knowing that, oh, this is something we can automate, so let's automate that before we are sure that we need. And the second thing that makes me more proud, I think, of these automations is that it only ran twice. The first time when it found the bugs, and the second time after the bugs were fixed to verify it. We never run, as far as I know, the automation suite again, which is not what usually happens, that we let the automation suite that is available because we are used to think that it's very cheap. Okay, it's there, just press enter, it will happen. So we did not let it direct what kind of tests we want to do just because it's there and it's a low-hanging fruit, or we could think like that. The automation was there and we had the possibility of automating more or less, and we had this part automated, but still we all the time we decided what kind of automation are we trying to get now. And that directed us to decide when we want to build or run the automation and when we don't run it. So because we didn't saw any risk of having different information from running the automation again, we didn't run the automation again, even if it would be cheap. Because even if it's a very small time to run it, in this small time I can do something completely new with the product and discover something that I didn't know before. Even if it's something good, even if I just try something and the product still works, so I know about another part of the product that has no bugs in it. From this view of automation, I can like feel how we approach testing in a whole. And when I say we, I mean my closer testing team. Intel is very big, and each every 10 persons in the world completely different. So I mean, my closer testing team, that's how we approach. We try to make it as manual as possible, because manual is more adaptive, and by manual, you don't have, you are open for unexpected things. I would like to argue that testing is discovering. We try to discover new things. And the new things can be good things and can be bad things. Can be parts of the program that work, parts of the program that do not work. And if we are trying to answer the same question that we answered yesterday or on test cycle, then we're not discovering new things. And we may be feeling well because we have a lot of activity going on. And then we can start counting the activities, be it in test cases, be it in hours of tests or numbers of problems, usually new things. But if we're running something just to get, and we know that we'll get the same information, then we are missing there a point of what testing we are getting. And the summary of my talk also talked about teams. And when you focus on automation, you already come with a very, very clear view of what you expect from the test you're going to do. So, because you have to tell the computer what to pay attention and what not to pay attention. You cannot just, otherwise you'll have to watch it as he does the test and check all the logs and try to find unexpected things. But when you write anything that is as much scripted as to be able to automate that to a computer, you have to tell the computer exactly what to look for. And you're not open to look for another things. And that really reduces the collaboration that happens. When you don't know what to expect, then you talk. I wake up late today morning. You don't care about it. But there was a house was on the TV series. And then I just noticed that whenever they get stuck, and even House, when he gets stuck, then he talks with people. That's what happens when you are not sure what to expect next, and that's what happens when you are faced with some ambiguity. So it can be lupus, it cannot be lupus, you don't know. So he just gathers everyone and starts talking about it. The same thing will happen when you test. If you narrow the kind of things that we expect, because we have to tell to the computer that are very dumb, unless you use Intel processors, but usually they are not so smart, and you have to tell them essentially what to expect, and you reduce the ambiguity to a level where the program can really run in a smooth way, then you don't talk. I mean, and testers, especially if they know how to code, will come less and less to programmers to talk about what are the options here, and what could be different. They don't think about what can be different. In fact, testers will expect things not to be never different, because at the moment it's different. They'll have to rewrite all the automation again, and that's a very hard job. No one likes to work hard. So I don't want to diss automation. Automation is very good, and as I said, because of my disencouragement of automation, I almost made my team to miss a big part of the bugs that were in this last project. So I learned to like automation more. But I'm very afraid of automation or script testing when you do it manually without the name, of taking from the value that a testing team and a whole development team can have from both sides. I don't know here who tests and who tests. You mean? I forgot. She tests.
And he does.
Who tests? He does. And are there programmers here? You do both? You program as a tester?
Software engineer as well.
Usually most programmers don't come when there's title testing in the when it's writing testing in the title of the talk. So next time you have to not tell anyone it's testing, and then they will come, they'll be surprised. So, but the idea is that programmers, they start to see value as they start getting questions about things they haven't thought before. And these questions come from unclear positions. So there's a lot of ambiguity when we talk about software. You cannot, even if you go to the utopia of having requirements up front very clear, you cannot write the things that you imagine in a good way. And the more you deal with that and try to think about these things even before you start using the product, for a scripted test or for an automation of tests, then the less questions you have. And so everybody is stuck on the same kind of thinking. And programmers don't get the value of the testing team can give to them, and neither do managers. That's our most, like, the utmost client that we have. Like, we need to provide information to managers, information they don't have, and then they can decide of, okay, we will release, we will not release. I don't know how this is taken differently here, this community or not community. The community helps the side of that. It would be interesting to see if the community, because the community outside Mozilla knows the results of the tests before release.
They can see them. Whether they're actually looking at them, I think, is a much different question.
Ah, but they can see them.
If they're run through our test case management system.
So that's
the automation system is also public facing.
Okay, congratulations to Mozilla on that. That's a very transparent way of working. So it's also interesting because if we provide the service to the community, then community can see the testing and say, okay, we are fine with not releasing Firefox 5 on time because we saw that very nasty bug was there. That's enough decision not to release because the testing will not have this decision. Neither do programmers, but management can take this information and decide. Management cannot take information usually, like a list of numbers or color charts and decide based on them. Any of the usually metrics don't provide them information on the risk that the product has, but stories do. So when there are questions happening that usually no one knows the answer, so, okay, what should we do in that case? What the program should do? And programmers will not know anyway. They just decide, they fill the blanks that the requirement gives by themselves until someone asks why this and not something else. And then management start noticing what questions are still open. And then they can have a good idea to decide whether to fix or not.
So, a couple of quick things before you move on to exploratory. You touched on a couple things with automation. There was one thing that you said sort of in passing, but I wanted to highlight it, which is that you mentioned that automation has to be very focused in what it looks for. And I've seen an anti-pattern on both sides of that. One is that you're looking for very focused things, and management or whoever assumes that this takes the place of testing, which I'm sure is about to be the talk. But the other is that they try to make the automation too expansive and look at everything, and that drives your maintenance up into the sky because it becomes very, very fragile. But the other thing I just wanted to ask, you mentioned automation and its use. You know, standard automation tends to tilt towards regression-style tests, at least the stuff that you have in QA. Unit tests as well are basically regression tests. I don't see those so much as bug-finding things, although I recognize your automation, you have a lot of luck with that. I see those as basically assuring that you can move faster in the process. It's giving you some level of confidence that you can move forward without double-checking every cross T and dotted I. Obviously, it's not perfect, but that's where I see the main use of it to be. And I was just curious what your feeling on that was.
Yeah, we're just taking notes so I can address. I have a note here. Speak, talk into the mic, repeat the question. So I will do both now. Your name is? Jill?
Gio.
Gio.
Yeah.
So, Jill asked about two things about automation. First, about why I speak about automation on being a very focused thing that has a very narrow set of things that it can check or not. And the second thing is whether we really have to look at automation about as a discovery activity instead of just being something that make us feel secure and safe about whatever is happening under the hood. And both are good questions. I'll answer them separate. You can be less narrow and more broad when you have an automation. And I'm trying to think how to answer. I may just say, I don't know, but I think I have a feeling of what I want to answer. And I'll bring an example. There's a tester called Michael Bolton. He once was talking about something very similar. And then he asked me, let's say I'm on a bar, and I ask, what do we just for a bottle of Stella Artois beer? And she brings the bottle to me. So is that okay? Is that fine? So do we have a problem here? She brought the bottle. Maybe it's empty. So we may have a problem here. So let's say she brings the bottle and the bottle is full. Are we fine or do we have a problem here? I don't know, maybe it's water instead of beer. Let's say it's beer. Maybe it's hot, so I don't want it hot. So let's say it's cold, maybe it's different beer inside the bottle. And let's say it's 10 or 12 and it's cold, maybe it's past the expiration. And so you can start to broaden the types of things you tell your automation to look at. But you can never tell the automation just to look for problems. Right? Okay. You receive a packet back, now check, think of if there is any problem here. It can be anywhere, in the time it took for the packet to come back, or in the content of the packet, or if there was a packet was repeated and came again after a few seconds. So a tester can do that without you telling him to do that. So a tester automatically will have, if no one took that from him, he will automatically look at the things that are outside and no one told him. So that you can do that with automation. You even if you broaden, you still have a very narrow focus compared to everything that could be there. So when you try an automation of discovery, you never have as much discovery as you could if you had someone trying that manually. And when you don't look at automation as discovery, and you do, like you said, the regression test, then sometimes it can be valuable or not. We have to be careful with this feeling of how secure we are. And as I said, I borrow my the things I think from other people. So I don't mention, there's another guy called Brian Merrick, who wrote a paper on when to automate the test. And he starts the paper saying, what if I run a set of tests now and everything is looking now fine and I don't have anything automated, and so a few months from now things change and I'm not able to, unless I try to start to do everything manually again, I don't have a way to run them automatically and I don't know if they are still testing. And he goes there, will I not feel terrible that I'm missing this coverage now? And he writes that our objective is not feeling well, right? Sometimes we have to feel terrible with fear of having missed something there if it's really not valuable to look at that. And there are companies, even big hardware processor companies somewhere in the world where that I can't mention, where regression tests and knowing that there is a whole lot of activity going on that brings repeated results over and over again every week makes people feel better. So, okay, yeah, I don't know, we may have something hidden there in places that we haven't tried yet. But at least things that we tried are still just as we tried. And it's like having the babies that have a blanket and, okay, I will hold these test results and I want them every day at morning to see them over and over again. And green, and as soon as they are green, I'll feel safe, even though there might be monsters somewhere else in the program. So I'm not saying it's bad, I'm just saying it's dangerous. I will not say never do that, I will not say do that every time. I just think we have to be careful of trying to feel well with having results that are repeated if they are not really dangerous, and we just do that to have a good activity.
So if you talk about testing as discovery, it seems more valuable to have people moving on past things that you have already been through and discovered. So if the waitress brings you a bottle of Stella and it's empty the first time and you add an automated test for that so you know it's never going to be empty again, then your tester doesn't have to worry about that. Your tester can take their mental energy and focus on other things. And if it comes back with water, then you add an automated test and it's never water again. And that's how we do a lot of our testing in our, I mean, I'm a web developer, and in our test suite, we focus a lot on, okay, we found this, and now it's never going to slip in again because we've added regression test for it that we didn't have coverage. That works with, that's using exploration and exploratory testing to help build the automated suite. And you're right, it's not going to discover new issues, but it takes away all of the mental burden of checking for the things that have been discovered. So in that way, it's the exploratory testing builds.
What about change? I mean, one of the key things about automation is change detection. You know, just to know that your code base has changed in terms of behavior. So you do get notified of that. And then I wouldn't say you never test in that area again.
No. Yeah, I mean, to your specific point, I would say that the danger is that they never look to see if it's half full. They assume that the test has a wider scope than it does. And I think that's exactly where you were going with that, is that that's the danger. People don't understand that automation is very limited scope as a general rule. And I think that one of our jobs as testers, specifically as automation engineers, is to communicate loudly upwards exactly what the tests are covering to the extent that we can, and not give people a sense of false security.
But to your point, I think it's you can plan your testing, you know, with a little bit of knowledge about what the automation program, and maybe more, you know, knowing what it covers, and then, you know, doing prioritization. Because I would cover, like, let's say, you know, the new stuff, as opposed to the, you know, the old stuff that, let's say, is covered by the automation. So if I only have time, I'll only test the new stuff.
Right. And
so, I guess...
Yeah, I'm trying to say we use automation to remove, like, if stuff has changed or stuff is new, then yes, it needs to be prioritized attention of somebody doing it manually. If it's not changed, it's not new, and we just, you know, we're using the...
True. I mean, and I guess... Depends, you know, just how much you trust, you know, those tests. And that, because Geo brings up a good point, there's lots, you know,
testing that a bottle is not empty is not the same as testing that it's full, right? Like writing a bad test doesn't do anything.
True.
I've seen a lot of bad tests.
Yeah, and we should.
Yeah, I mean, not here specifically.
I'll try to speak into the mic, repeat the question. So I try to summarize for people at home. I know that at least my wife is there, and I don't know how many other people have online. But so we had a comment about automation being useful when built in an incremental way, just to save testers from doing some tests. And then it was mentioned as an additional counterpoint about the danger of the false security that it can give, not only to managers, like I mentioned before, but that is a very good point. It gives a false sense of security to the testers that, okay, someone else is looking at here, this robot, and I don't need to. But this is a good thing that happens. Like, if things need to be repeated, sometimes it is useful to automate. When you have a complete change in code, so you start, I don't have an idea to rewrite time from scratch on this scratch, but you have a complete rewriting of a program, then it may be useful to have something that will look at something that everybody knows that has to be looked at, and the testers will look anyway, but you receive fast feedback from that. That's a good thing. We have the product I test is embedded software. It runs on the chipset, on the motherboard, and so every time you have a different motherboard, much of it has to be rewritten to comply with the new hardware limitations or the new hardware capabilities. So automated tests on these models are very useful. For the rest of the year, whenever we are running the same automated tests again, it's just for to feel well and not to get information from there. And to look over the other point. So I think, are there more questions on this? All these texts. Okay, so if no more questions, then I will go to the second part, that is about exploratory testing and how the view I have in exploratory testing, and this may be something, it's not new, but it's something that, it's not how I see it explained usually, is that exploratory testing will happen all the time, even when you have you know, some different ways that have only automated tests and only scripted tests. There is an exploration happening because there are bugs and someone has to isolate the bug or investigate the bug in order to write it into the not see that, whatever you write the bugs. And you have tests happening on disposable time, you have tests happening before you automate, so you know how to automate this thing. You have tests happening when you're writing a test case and a test plan, just thinking about what you have to write, even if the product is not there, just bringing these questions of what you want to write in this test plan, it's all part of exploration. And when you have a bug reproduction from somewhere on the community report, when you have to reproduce it and try it because it's not happening, that's all exploration. So you cannot do that without like thinking it beforehand if you're not trying at the same time and thinking and redesigning the next step you'll take at this very time. So when I am a big promoter and advocate of exploratory testing at Intel, for example, and other places. But what I advocate is not to let's start doing an exploratory testing. First, because then people are afraid of changing, want to start something new that's not couldn't be any good. And the second is because people don't notice that there is already a lot of exploratory testing going on, and we are just not taking full advantage of that. So you may have places where a tester is running over a set of test cases that he had to run. Maybe part of them are automated, and he is working alone. And at the end of the day, he only reports the results of like pass or fail those tests. And no one noticed that during the day, before he started, after he finished, and during his test, he was doing a lot of exploration. Just no one was talking with him about that, and he wasn't telling that to anyone. And because it's like agreed by everyone that this is just part of the things that we do in a hidden way, and no one takes benefit from that. And everybody loses in this case. So a test lead do not get the feeling of what problems and obstacles the tester had during his test. The tester, especially if he's new, he has no one to teach him how to do better this exploration, how he can try the bug isolation better the next time. And the managers are missing a feeling of the tools of how hard is it really to install this product, because testers are just working around problems because they already know how to. So I advocate that in every place already has a whole bunch of exploratory testing that no one needs to modify or add to. We just need to be aware and start working, taking benefit of that. So, let's see. I wish I had more things written here now that I haven't written yet. But the feeling is like that. We have people wanting information. They just are not sure what kind of information they want. So all they know is a fixed number of test results and pass and fails. We have testers that want to learn how to do exploration better because that's the part that's really challenging. And no one is helping them to do that. And we have a tester that is running between these two parts of the, like, they have to bring numbers very quick to the management, and they have to just help the testers go over the problem so they can run the next thing. And all this information and learning that is two-way is being missed. A test lead can benefit a lot if he just listens to, instead of just listening what, okay, a tester finds a bug, number 1344, and instead of just looking what's the bug and how's the severity, asking how did you find the bug, how did you isolate the bug, what else did you try, brings so much more information about the system than the bug by itself. So all this exploration is just lost. And that's what I mean when I say that there is a lot of exploration going on. You just need champions or someone that starts working with people to get the information, and maybe having it documented or just passing around different people inside the team or outside the team. It's more a problem of awareness and being willing to work with it than a problem of changing the way we work now. Yeah, that's a good thing. So, these are, you can see here some words, result, interpretation, continues here. These are all very powerful words, in my view, that determine how a person works, and actually what a person is when he works, and the kind of thinking that he does, and the kind of interaction he has with other people in his team. That it's usually what we expect of anyone when we hire them, unless, especially if we are trying to hire less. And we are looking for people that will have responsibility and learning and will know how to interpret results instead of just reporting them and being engaged and everything. And these are all parts of the big, maybe the most detailed description of what exploratory testing is. And so I don't want to enter here in the description of what exactly exploratory testing is, although I could if you have questions, but I like to emphasize that exploratory testing is a lot of personal characteristics going on, and it's a lot of the way the team works and dynamics between different teams and the things that management expects from people. So it's much more about the people and the way we work with them than about who we use, unless it's my tool, and much more about people than about the technique that we will use or how we report things. It's the way people feel at work. So if we give them freedom and we give them responsibility, you will have exploratory testing. And you will have good exploratory testing if you take advantage of that means. Other descriptions are shorter, but they don't have these nice points. And Ken Kenner does a very good job of putting the important stuff in his definitions. So this is maybe, and I'm bringing this because I don't like this. This may be the biggest question that I have when I talk about exploratory testing, both at Intel and inside. Is that the idea that, okay, yeah, exploratory testing is great, and we will work with people that already do exploratory testing, but we need the best testers to do that. I will work on the exploratory testers of the very experienced people and the very knowledgeable, because they will do great exploratory testing. And that's just not true. We cannot just wait for someone to become great and experienced just because he's been 5 years at Ozima. The way for this person to become experienced at the second year is to work with him all the time and to see where he gets stuck and help him to get unstuck and what kinds of things he think and add to him two things to think about. And after you do that over and over again, then you don't need for someone to be a long, long time to be experienced. It becomes experienced automatically. You don't have, quick feedback is the best, is the only way we evolve, even with kids. You can't wait for your kid to learn to speak alone, and he will, just by listening to TV. But if you give feedback when he says mama, and say, no mama, it's papa. So he learns to speak papa first. So this quick feedback is what makes people evolve. They can evolve alone. Just let them see and they will be in the community and they will be listening to things and they will become great, but it will take a lot of time. And you don't need that. You can work with people if you have good people to work with them. So anyone can be an exploratory testing and they will be doing as a good job as this lead or mentee or mentor can be to them. And that's why the hardest part to start working with exploratory testing is it's not on the testers, but it's usually more to the side of management or peers around. And managers are not sure what kind of information they can receive, and they get confused when you say, okay, we will now explore and try to find the information that we want. What information do you want? And they have no idea. I want numbers. And that's the hard part. The testers are doing this exploratory testing anyway, and if you work with them, you'll just be happier. The hard work comes from the managers, when they start to receive, together with the numbers they receive until now, a lot of stories about what people feel about the product, because that's what quality is. If you talk to someone that's not here, and you ask your mother how she likes the new dishwasher, then you will not receive an answer that say, oh yeah, it has 3 buds, and 2 of them are very high severity. She'll tell a story. Oh, it's good, but it's a little bit noisy sometimes, but only if I put too much things inside. So quality are feelings and stories. Imagines don't get that unless there's someone listening to the testers about what their feelings are and bringing that to management back. So, and that's the hard part, because testers are just eager to tell someone their feelings. And guest managers are not used to listen to that feeling, because no one has ever told them that that's an option. Mike, you can disagree. Not you. So, I think this is my last slide before I just show my tool that's very small. And this is an idea of how to make this exploration and the quick feedback work in a very easy way. It's it was called session-based test management. A friend of mine from the Netherlands started to use it the other way around, and it works much better. And when input management at the front of the trace, it sounds much more safe for managers. Okay, someone's managing this. Instead of plus this session-based thing, so it is a good way to manage tests based on sessions, and sessions are nothing else than uninterrupted time with testing activity. So a tester goes, he works for 2 hours, usually it's 1.5 hours, 2 hours, doing whatever he wants to do, or even if it's following a script or running the automation, and after that someone sits him for 15 minutes to half an hour and speak about that time and try to see what else was there apart from the list of passes and fails. That's all there is to session-based test management. So there are other things like adding a charter so the tester knows what's the path that he has to follow when he tests and the types of things we are looking at this time. And the tester takes notes, but it's the most important part of the session, and brings results back to our reviewer. Now, on this debrief, so everybody is learning. That's the first time that the tester has someone to tell him how to use testing techniques while he tests, instead of we having, and it happens. Sure, not here or in my company, but in other companies in Silicon Valley, it happens that the testers, they are doing tests following some idea that someone else wrote, so they're not using the techniques as they test until they are 4 years in the company. Then they start writing test cases for other people using techniques. So no one is never using the techniques as they test. They're just using the techniques when they write. And so when you review a two-hour session of someone, and he said, okay, I tried these and these and these, and you can tell him, oh, we have a different technique. We can try to divide these in a pathways way. And you teach him how to take the data that he just got from the software to divide parallels and try the next thing. And people are learning to use techniques as they test. And then by the time they write the test cases, they will be much better at that because they try that freely. And so the tester is learning and the lead is learning what problems are there. So usually we are looking for obstacles that the tester got and overall feelings and a list of bugs, but much more quality information than what we get when we just get a number of, okay, I had 3 bugs out of the 7 tests that I tried. So it's all about having quick feedback and very quick, it's a very good for course correction too. So it can be scary to tell, okay, I'll leave my testers to do exploratory testing for the next 3 months and I'll come back later and see what happened during these 3 months. Maybe they did something wrong. But when you have 2 hours and you can correct the course at that time, then it's okay, no big risk, right? Maximum, they learned something that wasn't, they weren't supposed to learn now, they learned now, but should happen done later. But you missed 1 morning, nothing more than that. And everybody is still benefiting from that. So that's an idea of session-based. We could give a whole talk on session-based, and there are talks like that, but it's not a complex thing. You can read on the internet, it's enough. But for the review and for accountability of what has been tested, that another fear is part of the testing. Okay, so what did you do? If you don't have test cases, how do you keep track of what did you do? The notes are maybe the most important part of exploratory testing. So you can have bad charters and not do a good debrief, but the notes are the things that will help you to have a good debrief and to be accountable for what you did. And And for these nodes, is where Rapid Reporter was invented. So I will show, it's a short demo. I'll show the demo unless you have questions about exploratory testing and session based. I was so here.
Actually, well, one thing. You may have mentioned it, if so, I apologize for asking you to repeat yourself. What exactly was the charter?
The charter is, it's not an objective, but it's a path to follow. It's like test the, or can be an area, like test the open file that comment in the menu, okay? And that can take 3 sessions of 1 hour and a half. It can be test the menus in different resolutions. So it's, it can be an area or a type of test, like something that will focus instead of, okay, go wild on the software, that it can happen. But it's usually, it helps.
I mean, that could be your charter, right?
And you usually start with a charter that is just a reconnaissance charter. Okay, take the software and start playing with it. Maybe your notes of what the software, what's everything that exists in the software. So the tester will try those different things. But after you have this, like, reconnaissance charters, you have a list of areas that you want to cover until the project ends. So it's useful to try to set a path, okay, now work on this area, the next time you work on the other. The tester is entitled, though, to go an opportunity time and try off-charter things if he is feeling that something interesting there. And it's fine, because you can correct that at the next session. So he can come and tell, okay, this thing was weird, I thought I could crash, so I wrote it 2 hours and I managed to crash, and you'll be happy that you tried something else. But if you didn't manage to crash, you can say, okay, stop trying to crash it, I will take a note for this for the next charge of someone, because this week we want to finish the menu parts.
Cool, thank you.
So, we have to finish at 4:30.
You're doing fine.
Okay.
I think people leave as we do.
Okay, thank you. So, a short history of Rapid Reporter. As I told, we always did exploratory testing because everyone is doing it even when they don't know. But when I moved to a small team where I thought I had, and I really did have, enough autonomy to try things different, I wanted to do most pure exploratory testing as we could. So, we did not work on test cases or test plan before. We talked with the programmer, with the managers, and with the people that were the customer of this tool to get their expectations out of the tool and review a big mind map of what you know the tool knows to do. And that was all we had there, the mind map. And when we started working, then we noticed that this product works on a different set of operations, so we had the mind map and a table of what are all the functions of the software. That's all we had, and we, according to the mind map, we defined the areas for the charters. This was the first time that I was working on 100% session-based testing with exploration. Some of the testers were more experienced than others. Some of them was the first time they were doing an exploratory testing in an official way, and they were even scared. What does that mean that I can decide what to do next? That we're not used to that. So the notes are very important to me, because I wanted to sit with everyone at the end of the session and talk and learn what they learned and teach them whatever I can. And so those were the most important parts. And to make them flexible, we started by handwriting on a notebook. Not a notebook, that's on paper. And it was good for the notes, but it was a mess to manage, and I had to work after hours to try to put that on the computer in a way that we can search data, and it was not so good. So we moved to Notepad. It wasn't still good. We moved to, by then it was maybe the only one session-based note-taking software called Session Tester. And we worked with this for a while, but notes weren't so good because it was hard to take notes. A Session Tester is big. It has all the theory of session-based test management is on the tool. You have menus and you have to think about how you are organizing your notes. That made the notes to come slowly and usually small and weak. And the testers were not happy that it was hard, but the overall idea is that it's hard, but it's work, so that's what we do. this type of thinking really hurts. So after one time that we had a talk about that, on the way home to the bus, I started drawing how should the ultimate note-taking tool look for writing. And I came up with something very, very small that it's like a flip camera where you press a button and start, you press a button and stop. That's all my tool did. And the first version of it had 300 lines of code, and now it's helping you understand the code with 700. But it's still very simple, but suddenly many, many teams all over the world started to take it. And there are no people using it in Japan, in the Netherlands, in the United States, in Brazil, in Israel. It is so easy to use, and because it's small, the testers are already using it. I got permission from Intel to release it as a tool, my open source, because I worked after hours for it. And this is all the tool. So the first feature is that it's yellow. The second feature is that's always on top. And these were really the first two things that I decided even before I knew what I wanted the tool to do. I wanted it to be yellow and always on top, so testers can just switch to it and write without having to look for it. And think, hey, where is the note-taking tool? It was here somewhere, and start out having to find it. So it's always there. So if you are testing, let's see. So ideas and Internet Explorer. The last thing I have Firefox. So. Not the better, not the man. Oh, I do on your updates every day. Who tests this thing? I don't
that's because the Wi-Fi
is on. So, okay. It's here. Hi. Oh, red. Okay, so let's say I'm testing Firefox now, and so that's my tool. It's the other one, it's always on top. So even when you're working with Firefox, you know that the tool is there, and it's, whenever you put it, it will be there. Like you don't need to think about where it is. So you don't lose testing cycles from that. So if you're here and you want to write something, you just move to it and oh, and start writing. So to can I talk about this? Yeah, great. Automation. The tool lets you choose where you want to save the results of your testing. Let's save it in a Mozilla place. So I am let's say I write my name and I write my testing is a demo. After these two things, the tool started to work. And all you see is all the tool does in its basic configuration. So you can start to write here your setup, Windows 64, 764, whatever you write. And you press enter, it's logged, it's saved every time, so if it crashes, you don't lose your information. And when you write something just by pressing up and down, even while they write, you change the type of note you're taking. So if now you are reporting a bug, or you are asking a question, or you are just suggesting something for the next session you or another tester will do, and you just change it by pressing up and down. So the tool is organizing now all the nodes behind your back. You don't need to think, there are many people that use one node, and then you have to go to the area that you want. Well, this is an idea, this is a bug. Because you can just tell the tool what's the type of node you're taking, it takes care of that for you.
Can you show the report real quick? Because I'd like to see your report that comes out. I'm assuming there's a...
Yes, I have one prepared, because I did a demo of this at Starist. It saves everything in common separated value, because then you can let Excel, you can manipulate everything on Excel. So I will show two things that it has. So you can have it in a comma separated value where everything is timestamped, as you see. So with all the different nodes, the best set and vehicle. So this is a node, this is a something for the next time, or there's a file history, so maybe struck in the registry, someone has to test that. And you will not be here, but they will see how a tester can take screenshots and extend the nodes all the time. So every node can have, let's take the zoom out, please. So every node has or not an attachment. You see at the end of the screenshot. And before you leave, this can be transformed in an HTML report, so managers can understand it easily and see, okay, this is the node, this is the screenshot, this is the bug, it's red. And so with this, you can review a 2-hour session in 20 minutes, very quickly.
I like it. Thanks a lot.
I like it too. So, speed up browsing. So now everybody's curious about the screenshots. Before the screenshots, I want you to pay attention to... Let's talk about screenshots before. Okay, no, let's talk about this. Default time is 90 minutes of a session. You can have smaller sessions like 60, or you can just not have a timer at all. What happens when you have a timer is that you see here behind the, but we have a progress bar going on. It will reach the end 60 minutes from now, because that's all I wrote. It will not stop the reporter from working, so the tester can stop before the time or after the time, but it helps him to see, okay, I'm towards the end, so I may want to come back to the chart very well. It helps the tester to decide what the next action to do. It doesn't mandate any action on the tester, so it doesn't start buzzing. A small icon appears on the corner, but without bothering the tester. The idea is to have something that is never obtrusive to the tester's thinking cycle. The tester is thinking about the test. And he just writes one note at a time. As you can see, there's not a list of notes here. So tester do not need to think about how he organized notes. He cannot even see them. He can, however, if he presses with the right click here, choose a previous note just if he wants to make something very similar. But he cannot go and change, which is a good thing, because when the tester, and that happens to me too, sometimes I write something in my note that is a bug, and 15 minutes later I discover it's not a bug, I'll just delete that or fix whatever I wrote. But then that confusion is lost. So when you as a test leader are talking to the tester and you don't notice that he got confused for 15 minutes, you miss a lot of conversation there. So here this conversation happens, because he will have a note that writes that the sales, bug, KGA, yes, let's say something is a bug, and later he will say, no, that was not a bug, it was something else. And then you can talk about the confusion, because if he got confused, something is wrong there. So the tester do not think about whatever he already wrote. Everything that's written will come up on the discussion. If something is very terrible, like he wrote some colors or some profanation, he can always open and change the comma separated value or a notepad, and it works like the tool does not lock it for anything. But it's not part of the use of the tool to change these things. Now the other, there are other three things in the GUI that are cute. There's a transparency in case the tester just still wants to see the whole screen. I only know about one team in England using that, but people like it. And the two important things that are left here in the GUI is the option to write a more than one line note. It helps because then you can add you can copy a log file, you can copy a whole text of a page, you can copy an error message. It's also it's a rich text, so it's flexible, and you hit save, and you can see the button changed a little bit. This next node will have this as an attachment. Same thing happens when you press here. It takes, now you didn't take a notice, it took a screenshot of the whole picture. If you don't want a screenshot of the whole picture, you press with shift, and it opens here, so you can select only the area you want, and crop, and same, and that's the attachment you had. So you can see these the attachments we took now here, right? This is the screenshot, this is the screenshot of the part, this is the extended node, all appears in the comma separated file that you can open in Excel. So you can follow with the tester, okay, this was your setup, and you took this as a node for the next time, and then you had this node with a screenshot and an extended node, let's look at it. If you don't want from here, you can look at it from the HTML, and it's just a link that you press and you see it. Like here, here it was, let's close this. Ah, that's all. Excel's all, not mine. So this is a session I did with a friend there at Starist. I knew I would have not had time to make a full session here thinking with you, but you can see we are testing FreeMind, another open source product. And we noticed that it opens with the last MinMind initiative, even in the dashboard version, so there is something that's registry here, and this is the screenshot that we saw in the last file opening, and we had one test. Okay, what happens if a file is already open? And there was no bug here. The file opened, but then we discovered it opening together. So if you read the notes and you see the screenshots, you get a lot of information. You want to see the extended notes. In this case, was are you okay? These are the two folders MindMap was looking for information on the on FreeMind was using for information on the MindMap. So this is an extended node attached to a simple node that says that there is an obscure folder where FreeMind is accessing, and I just added the name of the folder to that part. All these, as you can see, happened during 25 minutes of testing with someone else. We just wrote down everything that, like the things that we talked with one to each other, questions, what happened, oh, look at this. We just wrote them down on Rapid Report, and Rapid Report organized that for you. The good thing is that because it's on a comma separated layer, and you can use your spreadsheet of choice to manipulate it, you can just look at bugs and say, okay, these are the two bugs from the session. You can consolidate 14 sessions and look only at the list of bugs or only at the list of questions. And then on your next meeting with the product manager, you just take the list of questions and say, okay, we were thinking about these things. How do you answer them? In a very easy way. And that's all the visual part of Rapid Reporter. Rapid Reporter has another, I'll just finish that, has some accelerators for advanced users. And it's written in .NET, Microsoft thing, but it's so I don't know if you can see, I believe you can. Yeah, it's big. It has these accelerators that help. It has an accelerator to transform any comma separated value from a Rapid Reporter into an HTML page, the same one you saw. And it has also an accelerator to take many comma separated files. You have sessions from different team members, from different days, and it takes all of them and just concatenate one after the other in one big report file, so you can have all the sessions from your project in one file that you can then transform to HTML to. This HTML, I didn't show you, but it can be stylized with a regular style sheet. So you can put the Mozilla logo, and so other people use that because they give consultancy services to other companies, so they can do the real report with the company logo and colors. So, and when you have this whole report, you can use your spreadsheet to count how many bugs were found per session, how many time of testing was all along. You can start looking at, okay, most of our time we were dealing with the setup or dealing with bug investigations. And And the next part, and this is nice, serves many purposes, is that the two rapid reporting logs have anything you write as log types. So, for example, some of the people that use rapid reporter in the Netherlands, they don't use English, so they instead of, they don't write this question node because it's English and they like other languages. So they just write here other things like ETA, this is node in Dutch, and frag, this is question, but every single value comes from them. So I started to learn another. So this is, let's say, we use defect for bad, something like that. When you open up a reporter like this, you will just have your own set of types. And that helps because many companies have their own language, so they don't say bad, they say defect, they say issue. And they're very particular about that, to the point that people are fighting. So every company can just add things. If you don't like to have a node for checks and for tests, then you remove one of them and use only the ones you use. And that makes Rapid Reporter very versatile and flexible. I'll show you another thing that I haven't planned, but it's nice. I listened to a webinar by Guy Kawasaki, you know him? The Apple guy?
Apple.
Yeah. So I listened to the webinar, and all the while I was with Rapid Reporter open and recording things he said. Because I can take screenshots. I took screenshots of the webinar, and so I have the whole webinar here with his code. So I changed the types of the notes to be lecture code. Probably I have something like question. I may have. No, I don't have questions. I don't notice them. Yeah. So I have something that is question. So at the end of this webinar, when someone has questions, I could go back and look at my questions to maybe if I wanted to ask. So there is a guy, Ajay Balamur, that is using Rapid Reporter to take notes during meetings. So he writes the name of a different person, and he takes notes of all the brainstorming that's going on. It's who said what. It made it like a very flexible tool to take notes overall. And so we use this on weekend testing to take notes and just send one to the other very easily. And that's how it's got. It got more than that, because it's been growing with requests. I try to fix bugs. This is the open source part. It's open source. I can show you my...
You need to get online.
What? Not online? Yes, Firefox.
It's
access code.
I got Firefox for the capital one.
I see it on your shirt.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So, I use Fossil version control. I don't know if you know it. It's great to test. I really like it. Let's show all the check-ins, the last 2000 entries. I'm the only programmer on that, so it's a very linear check-in and check-out process. Okay? I just add to it. Sometimes I experiment with something and drop it, and we'll add it later. But it's on the web, so anyone can take a snapshot of things I do or I try at any given moment. No one knows. But I don't care. I like people complaining on bugs. I like that a lot. I try to fix bugs as quickly as possible. I try to add features as slowly as possible. Things lose severity as the time goes by. So after you have a bug for 2 months, you start thinking, oh, it's not so important, I can work around it. And then I may risk not to put it in. But that's what I want to happen with features. Because it is a good tool because it doesn't do anything other than what I showed you. Like, if I start adding, people say, oh, why don't you add a dialog that does that, and a menu, and I have no dialog philosophy. Apart from this exception dialog, there are no dialogs on the tool, and there are no menus, just to make it real simple. So it's on the web. The tool was not public for almost the whole of 2010, because we are I'm paranoid working at Intel because they are paranoid too. So I wanted to make sure that they would not mind me publishing things open source on the internet until I got permission. So at the end of 2010, it got out. It's maybe 7 months out, something like that. I have at least 20 different companies that are sending me problems all the time, which is good. It means someone is saying value on it. There aren't any bugs if there's no value. And I learned that in one of my first years at Intel. There was this big internal testing guru called Guy. I liked him very much. And we were talking about bugs, and I said to him someday, well, but every software has bugs, right? This is the way we think. There is no software without bugs. And then he told me, what if the software has no users? If a tree falls on the forest and there's no one there to listen, does it make sound? And it was a big, insightful moment for me, because if no one sees any value at all on software, and no one is using it, then there are no bugs. I mean, Windows 3.1 has no bugs nowadays. Right? Perfect problem, perfect software. It's not bugging anymore. So in these 7 months, there are companies, smaller and bigger, that are using it around the world. It's not, I don't make any money out of it. And I had written commercial software before that. So, but still, these are the most rewarding 700 lines of code that I've ever written. Just because it's something that is useful. It started scratching my personal itch, and then I noticed that it's useful for many other people. If you start using it, I would be happy to listen about the problems you have and try to fix them. And about features you have, I consider it all of them, and just don't always add the features in. And you are open source guys, so you can start fixing bugs for me too. I don't need to do that alone. I have a ticketing system here where. So these are the tickets open nowadays. Not so much. It's a simple software, useful tool, I think so. It helps, as I said, forget the tool. I just think that reviewing this was a 35-40 minute session that can be reviewed within 5 to 10 minutes with a tester in a very good level of detail of what was the cognitive process the testing was having during this half an hour. And it works the same thing after 2 hours of tests. You can just know. And it's all text files, so they are searchable with your Google search or Windows search. Whenever someone say, what kind of text did we run on the file open menu? You just search on this folder for file open, and you'll see all the things you tried in all the different sessions. So it's accountable.
I want to open up some questions, if people have questions.
Sure, we have to close soon.
People may. There was one question online. This is very simple. It's almost too simple. The back of your laptop.
Yeah.
Where did you get that?
Okay. Thank you. This question is good. Let's talk about my laptop because I like that too. I just stood here. These are three levels of different type of stickers, and it's now a whiteboard. It's also a clipboard. So it's like my low-tech laptop. It's the ultimate note-taking device. I can take notes whichever way I want. I did not buy it anywhere. I can look at or show someone here. I have a laptop sticker that will not leave stains on the laptop, and then I have a blank white, like the ones you use to protect notebooks at school. Mm-hmm. And then I have a glass sticker on top of that, so it became white. Thank you for your question, Anonymous Internet User. I will do some instructables with all the steps. I have pictures.
So if you had It sounds like you've had some success with other companies adopting Rapid Reporter. Have you heard about any of those companies using it in conjunction with anything else, or have they wanted to take the data from the Commons Unlimited file and do something else with it?
Yeah, it's a good point. Although I had never went to a company to talk about Rapid Reporter, it's the first time it happened, I do, and I am now officially a vendor of a testing software. there are other companies using it. They don't use Rapid Reporter to report bugs. They use Rapid Reporter to take notes of bugs. So they use Rapid Reporter, then Bugzilla or Mantis or whatever they use to log bugs. I know that I got a request to make a feature to log bugs directly from Rapid Reporter into Jira, for example. So I know there are people using this to take notes and Jira to log bugs, and that's the way I think it should be. I haven't added this feature yet. I think it just will be too complicated and not give so much value. But maybe it could be valuable. I don't know. So it's only for note taking. It's not for bug reporting. It's not for time management. It's not for requirements management. It's just to have an accountable record of the tests done. Good enough? Is the internet silent?
Hardly. Yeah, there aren't any.
Oh, I want to read the transcript of the IRC. Are there many people there?
There's a few.
Hi, internet. The real world says hello. Okay, so anyway, if there are no other questions, I guess we can close. Thank you. Thanks.